Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hello, Alan. How are we doing today?
Oh, yeah, we're doing okay. It's a nice day out there, finally.
Yeah.
Goodness,
from
it's taken
a while.
From the
sliver that we can see outside the
yes,
studio
indeed.
Window.
It's the 11th of October. Where has the year gone, people?
Honestly, it's kind of just been speeding by. And
it's not good.
I genuinely thought it was still kind of like the August. So this is quite a shock to me.
Yes, I know. And I guess exams are coming up for those of you out there listening who are students.
Yeah, that's right. So listen in because you might get some help here.
And our first story is to do with students, in fact. And so I'm going to seek both of your opinions because you know what it's like to be a student. And this is a story about a guy by the name of Professor Maitland Jones Jr. Junior, even though he's 84 years old. And he is a professor of organic chemistry at New York University at NYU. Okay, and he's had a long and distinguished academic career, mostly at Princeton, which is, you know, top university. He retired from Princeton in 2007, and ever since then he's been on contract teaching at NYU. So teaching organic chemistry, which is his specialty. He has written a book on the subject, so, you know, he knows his stuff. And even though he's 84 years old, he was voted recently one of the 8 coolest professors at NYU.
Quite the title.
This is all online, yeah, and that's very nice. However, in August, he had his contract terminated. And the reason for this was that 82 students out of the 350 students in his class signed a petition. And some of the wording in the petition. Okay, so we are very concerned about our scores and find that they are not an accurate reflection of the time and effort put into this class. And another quote, we urge you to realize that a class with such a high percentage of withdrawals and low grades has failed to make students' learning and well-being a priority and reflects poorly on the chemistry department and the institution as a whole. Right, thoughts. What do you reckon?
My first thought here is that organic chemistry is, with, you know, no better way to describe it, it's a bitch. It's terrible. And I remember back in high school when you kind of had to do it, or at least the compulsory bit that was introducing organic chemistry, It was quite difficult. But surely these people at NYU, because they chose it as their major or whatever, they would have some kind of natural inclination to succeeding in this, or at least
my
interest.
My first question would be, are these results in any way prejudiced or discriminatory to the extent that they would, I guess, disadvantage students in any way?
Well, okay, so there's quite a high cohort of what they call over there pre-med students. Okay, so medicine usually is a graduate course over in the States, so you do an undergraduate degree and then you apply on the basis of your results there. And seemingly one of the required courses for medicine, not surprisingly, is organic chemistry. So, you know, you've got your heart set on being a doctor and you come to university and you come up against a subject that is not straightforward. That this is a subject that you've got to actually put some real serious work into. And according to Professor Jones, ever since COVID, he's just seen the results go off a cliff. So, and whether this has something to do with the whole let's look at Zoom videos and recorded lectures and stuff like that, you know, is that part of the whole problem here, that students perhaps have forgotten how to study? And, okay, so 82 out of 350 signed this petition. Okay, which means around about sort of 268 or there or thereabouts didn't. Okay, so they were perfectly happy with things. So, you know, what are we to make of this? Now, the university took the nuclear option here, and they just said, right, you're gone. Now, even though he's 84 years old, he seemed to be still giving good lectures and stuff. And, you know, so what should the university have done here? It seems that they had a largely appreciative class. You know, most of the kids in the class didn't bother signing this petition. And there's a minority who have raised an issue. And as soon as an issue gets raised at a university, boomf, it seems that, you know, this is the sort of thing that certainly can happen. So when this was announced, there were 20 chemistry professors in his department who basically came to his defense and said, no, you shouldn't be doing this. You're setting an awful precedent. Jones himself is saying that, look, you know, he really hopes that this doesn't happen to anybody else. He was thinking of retiring at the time. This just sort of speeded up the decision, I guess, and made it mandatory. But this, you know, it's a tough one. You're always going to get students who can't do the subject in your class. Always. You know, unless you are at an extraordinary institution like Caltech or somewhere like that where everyone's going to pass. But, you know, where lies the responsibility for the failure, I think, is my question.
I think it speaks to a bit of a disconnect in how performance in a class might be, assessed by students, which is primarily through their grades and their feedback, by academics, which might be through learning outcomes or whatever, you know, material or outcomes has gone into the courses that they've constructed, and through universities, whose feedback primarily is monetary.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, my biggest concern... Okay, so the quote, that we are very concerned about our scores and find that they are not accurate reflection of the time and effort put into this class. You don't get grades through just time and effort. You know, you get grades through understanding and doing and everything. And just... You know, sitting there reading the textbook time over time after time or whatever, it's not going to get you the grades. It's just not.
And well, it is also kind of scary because these are people who do want to eventually be doctors or in the medical profession.
Yep.
So if you can't have that grasp of a very key subject in what your future would be completely based around is a little bit scary.
And there's been a lot of comments to that effect as well, that, you know, people saying, I wouldn't want anybody who can't do organic chemistry cut me open, you know. So, so I guess, you know, the jury's still out on this. It seems to be an irreversible decision by the university, but it does really raise a scary precedent and really shows you, you know, what can happen when a bunch of students get together and are very, very determined. Interestingly, there's been a group of parents set up basically opposing all of this and saying that, look, for goodness sake, you're going to an excellent university. You should be intellectually challenged. That's the whole point. We're not just paying for you to, you know, just get a degree, an ordinary degree or anything like that. That's not the way it works. You need to be made to work beyond what you think your limits are and you know, really, really stretch yourself.
It's interesting that the petition doesn't speak to the extent to which the students feel like they have actually learned the material of the class and only the grades and the feedback that they've received.
Yes, yes. I think that's a very, very good point. And again, it would be interesting, yeah, to see the grades of the people who have signed this petition. But
it is only a quarter, though. You got 82 out of the 350.
Exactly. And, you know, how many are going to pass the course anyway? I don't know whether they grade to a curve over there or whatever, or whether it's a 50% sort of, you know, pass fail sort of thing. I don't know, but
it's to watch then.
It is a worry. Something to keep an eye on. Yeah, yeah.
Moving on to our second topic
for today. Yes.
Nobel Prizes have been a very exciting bit of news. And 2 weeks ago, we actually talked about the Ig Nobel Prizes.
We did indeed.
Quite a good giggle. But now we're back to the serious science. So tell us about what's going on there.
Okay. So, of course, number one, the chemistry prize, of course. So awarded to Carolyn Bertozzi from Stanford, Morten Meldahl from Copenhagen, and Barry Sharpless from Scripps. And the big name here... of the three, if I'm going to be brutally honest, is Barry Sharpless, because he's won it twice.
Ooh.
And there's only, I think, five other people who've won two Nobel Prizes, only one in chemistry prior to this. So this is absolutely massive. He got the Nobel Prize in 2001 for work entirely unrelated to this, and then he goes and gets it again. It's just frightening. he gave a talk here, 3, 4, 5 years ago, interesting guy.
Someone's got a bit of a crush, hey?
No. Ah, very, very interesting. Anyway, so they got it for, and I quote, the development of click chemistry and bio-orthogonal chemistry. So, in a nutshell, chemists make molecules, and that's a bit of a mare sometimes, often, in fact, okay? Because nature doesn't let you do what you really want to do, and you've got to, you know, take these individual bonds, you've got to break them, you've got to make them. It's not easy, sometimes. And so basically what these three workers did is they came up with a a new old idea, if I could sort of say that. There was a paper published back in 1960 where a German guy published a piece of work that showed that you could very easily, well, fairly easily anyway, link two molecules together sort of reproducibly, repeatedly, and in really good yield, which is really important for chemists. And the trouble was that you had to really heat the heck out of it to get it to go. And so that sort of languished in the literature for about 40-odd years. And then I believe it was Sharpless sort of went back to this idea and, you know, trawling through the old literature, seeing what had been done, and thought, oh, I might be able to get that to go at lower temperatures. So he threw in a little bit of copper just to catalyze it. Bam. Worked perfectly. Now, ridiculously, Meldahl at Copenhagen came up with the same idea at the same time. And that happens quite often. All too often, anyway, in science, I think.
Feels a bit suspicious.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? But they came up with the same idea independently of each other at the same time.
Wow.
And then Bertozzi, who was at Stanford, she, I guess, was obviously aware of this sort of work as well. But she now then took it to an extreme, I guess, and she was very interested in looking inside cells. And looking at where molecules were within cells. And one of the ways of doing that is you attach a little fluorescent probe to individual molecules, and then they literally glow in the dark. You shine UV light on them, and you can see actually where they are in the cell. It's really kind of cool. The trouble is you've got to carry out chemistry in the cell. You've got to attach those little probes onto the molecules in a living cell while you don't disrupt that living cell. And she realized that, yeah, this could be really, really good, but don't like the copper in there, because copper and cells don't go. Copper will kill cells. So she found a way of doing this reaction in the cells without having to use copper, which is just stunning. Absolutely.
Where did she get the heat from?
She didn't need the heat. That's the thing. What she did was to use a strained molecule, okay? And so she had these molecules that were rings, and they are inherently strained, and so therefore they react faster. Brilliant idea, and, you know, brilliant application. So she did really, really well. And so now this is this thing called click chemistry, basically molecular Lego. You can just sort of click things together and they just go, okay?
Wow.
It's a guaranteed way of joining molecules together. So really, really nice stuff. And Bertozzi was also, to her great credit, in a band with Tom Morello, the guitarist from Rage Against the Machine. So there you go. There's
Which is where she must have got the idea
there's
from.
There's your Nobel Clearly, trivia for the day. Yeah. Yes, yes.
But I guess physics, that's not as exciting to you as chemistry. But, yeah, would you like to talk
okay,
us through
we
this
can,
one?
We can very briefly take
We just saw Ellen
physics.
Look around the room to make sure no physicians were listening. Physicists.
So, for physics, we had John Clauser, Anton Zeilinger, and Alan Aspect. So, respectively, from the States and from Austria and from France. Difficult one to explain this. So, let's imagine, if you will, we've got two particles.
Don't say quantum or people tune out.
Indeed. And these we're going to make these photons, okay? So, these are particles of light, okay? And we're going to set them traveling in opposite directions at the speed of light. Okay, and we are going to measure the way in which they are polarized. Now, polarization, okay, you've all worn sunglasses, okay, so you know that sunglasses, if you look through sunglasses, it takes out the glare, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But if you rotate them 90 degrees, it doesn't really work so well, okay? And this is all about polarization. So we're talking about waves. Waves are polarized in all directions. In other words, they oscillate up and down in all ways, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When you polarize them, you take out 99% of it and you only get those waves that are polarized in the direction, essentially, of your lens. Okay. Right. So photons have polarization, and they also have this thing called entanglement. And in other words, basically we're saying, if we know the polarization on one of these guys, we know the polarization on the other, okay? But we don't know their polarization until we look at them. Okay, so we're going to set these flying off opposite directions at the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to measure the polarization of one of them. And immediately, we know what the polarization on the other one is.
Wow.
Now, how does that work? Because nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. These things are moving away from each other at the speed of light. And yet instantaneously, as soon as we measure a property of one of those photons, the property on the other one becomes determined.
That's incredible.
And this is what Einstein didn't like. Einstein didn't like quantum mechanics. He particularly didn't like this. He said there had to be something deeper in it. There had to be some sort of hidden information, essentially, that determined the properties of these things. And in a nutshell, basically what these people have shown that won the Nobel Prize said, no, there's no hidden information. They designed an experiment that said, right, there's no hidden information. These things know. These entangled particles have some sort of connection to each other that allows one to know what the other one is up to, essentially. And it's weird.
How accurately are we able to actually do this measurement?
Ridiculously,
is that possible?
Ridiculously accurately, yes. Yep. Really and honestly, they've refined this right down to sort of femtoseconds and stuff like that. It's really seriously impressive stuff. And why is it important? It's important because this is a fundamental property that's going to be used in quantum computing, which is going to be a big deal in the next 5-10 years or whatever. And it's all weird. And you know, if you're interested in this, I urge you to go and read about it. Einstein called it spooky action at a distance.
It really is spooky. It feels like a bit magical and just so bizarre. You know,
any advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, I think Arthur C. Clarke once said that.
Maybe in a decade's time, we'll be doing Dear Science with Alan Blackman and talking about quantum computing and magic. So
I'll be up here in my Zimmer frame.
Watch this space. Well, I didn't know that before.
Dear. I'll be hobbling around like Anika. Oops.
Shout out to Anika, who's still crippled from her knee
Poor
surgery.
Thing. Okay.
Well, thank you, Alan. Really interesting. We'll go to the sting now, which Christina has preempted for us.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.